This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Trees provide us with oxygen, shelter, and materials. This time of year in autumn, trees bring us joy. They also have a place in our culture, too, in our stories, our songs, our history. Today, Where We Live, we look at the long, long life of trees. It's the title of a new book by Fiona Stafford. Connecticut State Forester will also join us to talk about our treescape throughout New England. What species are abundant locally, and which ones are in danger? And later, WNPR science reporter Patrick Skehe will be here, along with a researcher working for National Geographic. Kevin McLean will tell us what we can learn from rainforest canopies, a place rarely explored. You can join the conversation this hour, 860-275-7266. Email where we live at WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining me now by phone from the UK is Fiona Stafford. She's a professor of English at the University of Oxford. She hosted The Meaning of Trees on BBC Radio's 3's The Essay, and her new book, again, is called The Long, Long Life of Trees. Fiona, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
In studio with me is Christopher Martin. He's director of forestry for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. Thank you for coming in, Chris.
Oh, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
I'll start with Fiona. Besides being an author, you're a tree enthusiast. When did you first become discover your passion for trees?
I think I've always been quite keen on trees ever since I was a little girl and picked up conkers and helped build bonfires in the garden and that kind of thing. But it's an enthusiasm that's probably become more conscious as I've got older. I think when you're a child, you don't really necessarily distinguish that this is something peculiar. But since I've got older, I've realized just how important trees are. So it's a very long-standing interest.
And why do trees fill us with, you know, wonder and awe?
Well, I think you actually only need to go and have a look at one. They're all around, but often because they're all around, we tend not necessarily to see them. I mean, I realize that people listening to this particular show probably do see them all the time, but it's surprising how many people don't really notice the trees down the street that they just pass or might be at school or whatever. But as soon as you actually stand and look at a tree, it's just a phenomenal thing, almost any species. They're just really, really beautiful, beautiful objects. And, you know, we're conditioned to look at paintings and think, oh, this is beautiful, or look at a building and we're told, oh, you know, this is beautiful. But actually trees are just remarkable, remarkable structures, I think.
And when you were saying that some people may go about their day and not really notice trees, is that becoming more common, or are we finding ourselves drawn back to trees in our communities?
I think that's a really interesting question. I would have said, you know, if you'd asked me that question 5 years ago, I'd have probably said I think people aren't really noticing trees very much. But actually, I think over the last couple of years, certainly in the UK, there's been a real growth in interest in trees, and especially if trees are kind of under threat, or there's a new development, a new highway that means a lot of trees are going to be cut down. People are more visibly concerned about this, I think, than they would have been a few years ago. I don't know whether that's the same in Connecticut.
Oh, it definitely is. Well, again, our state forester is here, Chris Martin. First, tell us, as state forester, what do you do?
Well, I'm the director of the Division of Forestry, so we manage about 170,000 acres of state agency property, forests, and we have a very robust urban forestry program. We reach out to private woodland owners, which own about 70% of Connecticut's forests. And also we have a actually very active fire protection program, where we have firemen that go out west to the large fires out west, and then also occasionally we do have fires in Connecticut. They suppress those.
And what about trees for you? Is this something that you were drawn to as a boy?
Oh, yeah. I grew up watching Lassie after school and was very active in Scouts. I was very fortunate to grow up in an area that was at the time rural, and there was well over 1,000 acres of woods around my house. So I was always in the woods exploring and learning.
Talk to us about, you know, obviously you are in touch with a lot of property owners around the state, and, you know, I get the impression that people in Connecticut appreciate trees. What's your take?
Oh, right on. Yes, we worked recently with Yale and did a pretty intensive study of woodland owners in Connecticut. And this is a study that is going on nationwide. And Connecticut's landowners really rise to the top as far as their knowledge of the benefit that their forests provide their community. They own them for wildlife and recreation. And oftentimes, surprisingly, they're concerned about who will own the woods after them. And some not so much wanting to pass them on to their children in fear of what may come of their woods.
Meaning that the land will get subdivided and cleared?
True, yeah. The folks that own woodland in Connecticut are very passionate about their ownership, and they like to get out there and hands-on, kind of that roll-up-the-sleeve Yankee style. And they've invested blood, sweat, and tears in their property. And so passing it on to someone else who may not have that same passion and enjoyment is concerning for them.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In studio with me is Chris Martin. He's the Connecticut State Forester. And on the phone with us is Fiona Stafford. She's an author and professor of English at the University of Oxford. And her book is called The Long, Long Life of Trees. Fiona, let's go through parts of your book. So when you open up the book, the chapters are divided by tree species. And I wanted to start with the mighty oak. What can you tell us about the oak?
Well, the oak is one of these trees that's been really, really important in human culture for a very long time. It obviously continues to be so, but certainly in Western culture, it's always been revered. I mean, it was a tree that was important to the ancient Greeks. It was important in Norse mythology. In Britain, it's got special kind of royal associations, which go right back. It's particularly associated with Charles II, who was the king who came back after we had a republic for 11 years. He came back and he made the oak tree his own because he had this very dramatic escape during the English Civil War. He was defeated at the Battle of Worcester, and he was fleeing from Cromwell's troops, and he hid in an oak tree, this is how he made his escape. And so when he was invited back as to be the king, he made a great deal of this. And of course, as he made a great deal of this and had everybody waving oak leaves and acorns, he was drawing on these much older associations of the oak with strength and with divine power. So it's a very kind of important tree in Britain, but it's also a very important tree for lots of other nations as well. And I think this is one of the interesting things, that everybody tends to claim their local tree as their own kind of special property, and they don't realize that actually somebody in a different country is probably doing exactly the same with the same tree. So that was something I was interested in with the oak especially.
I know we have a particular oak history here in Connecticut. I'll let our state forester talk about the charter oak.
Oh, it's funny the parallels between the UK and America. But our most famous tree obviously is the charter oak, which is a white oak that was in Hartford. It fell about 160 years ago, but it was estimated to be over 1,000 years old when it did fall. There's reports that they had a funeral procession for the tree when it came down. And, of course, the Connecticut Charter was hidden in there during some opposing views of how self-governing Connecticut could be at the time. This is like, I think it was 1662, so a long time ago.
Uh-huh.
And our Native Americans utilized that tree. They timed their plantings to when the leaves came out. So it really had a really historical value, cultural value for Connecticut.
When we look at our treescape in New England here in Connecticut, Chris, you know, how common are oaks, and are they under threat by, insects or other invasives?
Well, Connecticut is kind of unique in its geographic location, where we are at the confluence of northern hardwoods and Appalachian hardwoods. And so we have some of the most diverse forests in the nation. Many folks don't realize that initially. But within Connecticut itself, there are 16 different native oaks. And the oaks are doing pretty well, actually, overall. There's no new invasive insects attacking them. They're a strong, sturdy tree, very resilient. There are other species in Connecticut that are under threat. One in particular is ash. Emerald ash borer now is pretty much widespread. And in western Connecticut, we're actually seeing mortality from the insect.
Let's talk about the ash tree. Fiona, that's also featured in your book. We know that the oak symbolizes strength, but what about the ash, and how has that been used through the centuries?
Well, the ash is a very interesting kind of counterpart to the oak. Certainly in the British context, it's probably as much part of the culture as the oak, but generally less well recognized, though with the worry about ash dieback. Recently, people have become much more ash aware. But traditionally, it's been called the Venus of the woods. It's the tree of love, whereas the oak is this very kind of solid, sturdy tree, very hard wood, and often seen as a kind of manly tree. The ash tree has always been seen as a much more feminine kind of tree, and people used to actually collect up ash leaves, and young women used to wear them in their cleavage in the hope of attracting a young man. And there was a belief that if they did that, the first young man they saw would be their husband, which I've always thought sounded a bit of a risky approach. But anyway, this is one of the old traditions associated with the ash tree.
And have you seen a dieback in Great Britain? And, you know, how has it rebounded at all, the ash tree?
Well, we're still monitoring it, really. I think there's still a great deal of concern because it's wrought havoc in Europe, and it's arrived in the UK, and it's being monitored at the moment. And it's difficult to know what will be the consequences, whether it'll just kind of sweep through all the ashes or not, or whether we'll have some naturally resistant strains, because I think in Denmark some of the ash trees were naturally resistant and they've already begun to sort of repopulate their ashes. But it's such a prevalent tree in England that I think if ash dieback really does sweep across, as some of the predictions have suggested, it will be pretty devastating. And that's without the emerald borer insect arriving, which is what was just mentioned by Chris.
And Chris, how much under threat are the ash trees? I couldn't even tell you what an ash tree looks like. I'm more familiar with the oak and
sure.
the maple here.
Well, they're a beautiful tree. In fact, many ashes were planted in urban areas after the Dutch elm blight. They have a vase type structure to them. They're long, tall, and they have a vase, like upside down vase figure. And therefore, they're really compatible for urban areas. Connecticut's, ash represents about 5 to 10% of all trees in Connecticut, and it grows along roadsides. And we've had more of a utilitarian approach to ash, not so much as described in the UK. Very, very handy for Louisville slugger bats and tools, and we oftentimes use them for firewood. Splits easily, and the ash itself really is, I think, has a very cultural importance to Native Americans. The baskets are made from ash. We have green, black, and white ash in Connecticut, so there's three types of ash, and all are under threat. We're not sure what the outcome will be as far as resilience, remnant, trees themselves after the emerald ash borer sweeps through.
Is there anything that the state's doing to battle the ash borer?
It's very limited what we can do. We are informing landowners and municipalities to prepare. It's a financial burden, obviously, to take down all these trees and they become a public hazard. So trees can be treated, but it's a maintenance thing. It's an annual thing. We have to treat the tree to kill the beetle larvae that are inside the bark. We're giving a lot of advice to woodland owners on whether or not they should remove the ash from their woods or let them die. A dead tree in the woods is not a bad thing. Lots of dead trees can be a problem. So just, it's very much case by case on what's the most appropriate action.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about trees with Fiona Stafford, who's joining us from the UK. Her book is The Long, Long Life of Trees. In studio with me is Chris Martin, Director of Forestry for the Connecticut Department of Energy and Environmental Protection. What do trees mean to you? Do you have a question or a comment? 860-275-7266. We'll be back after a short break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We like our trees in Connecticut, so much so that you'll remember when Connecticut Light and Power, now Eversource, started clear-cutting trees along our highways and roads and near power lines. by our homes after damaging storms a few years back. There were plenty of residents who were not pleased. The state forester is in studio. I'm sure he remembers that time. Today we're talking trees with tree enthusiast Fiona Stafford. Her new book is The Long, Long Life of Trees. She joins us by phone from the UK. And as I mentioned, Chris Martin, Connecticut State Forester, rather, to hear to talk about our local treescape. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We got a couple of tweets. A tweet from Brendan who writes, "The engagement ring I had made for Joanna was from a piece of a sycamore that blew down during that October snowstorm several years ago." And a tweet from Nancy, "If you're a tree hugger or just a great book lover, you have to read Lab Girl by Hope Jahren." I think that's how you pronounce her name. Fiona, I wanted to go back to you again. Your book, you break up the chapters by tree species. Let's talk about the horse chestnut.
Okay.
Tell us about it.
The horse chestnut. Oh, well, another very beautiful tree. I mean, I'm sorry, it's quite boring for me to just say, oh, yeah, that's a beautiful tree. But the horse chestnut really is a fabulous tree. I think it's very distinctive. I think it is a tree that people recognize because of those lovely leaves. They're kind of like great big hands with the shape of them, and it has wonderful, wonderful blossom, and then those amazing spiky seed nuts, and the horse chestnuts come bursting out of those. So it's a very kind of satisfying tree. But it was interesting hearing Chris talking about the ash and the practical uses of it. I mean, horse chestnut is a wood that is not traditionally as useful as ash or oak. So it's always had a slightly different kind of cultural character, certainly in the UK. It was very much imported in order to look nice, really. That's what it does. That's its meaning, if you like. And so it's a bit different from some of the other trees that people have always planted because they knew they were going to want to use the wood for all sorts of purposes.
And the leaves are very unusual, very beautiful. Chris, how common are these? I think I see them along streets occasionally in neighborhoods.
Yeah, they are planted in urban areas. You know, one of the benefits of the horse chestnut in urban areas is that it doesn't grow very large. And so they don't necessarily interfere quickly with overhead power lines, which is, you know, one of the big issues with trees, obviously. You know, horse chestnut in Connecticut is kind of a testament to resiliency. They grow in some of the harshest locations here, thin, rocky soils, very low nutrients, and yet they're hanging in there. They're a strong tree, and they cover our most rugged landscapes here.
And unfortunately, the American chestnut, not here anymore.
Well, yeah, they still sprout. And, you know, amazing how they, almost 100 years ago, the blight came through, and yet they still sprout. Mm-hmm. And you'll see them, you know, maybe grow 3-4 inches in diameter, and then the blight hits them. The American Chestnut Foundation, and actually our Connecticut Agricultural Experiment Station, has done tremendous work hybridizing the American chestnut with the Chinese chestnut. They bring back the special characteristics of the American chestnut. And they're outplanting a hybridized chestnut now throughout the country and in Connecticut, hoping to bring that species back.
Now, if you see the chestnuts from the horse chestnut, you can't roast those, right?
No, I haven't heard of that happening. So maybe not quite as tasteful as a regular American chestnut.
And also the yew tree, that's another one that I think is pretty unusual. I don't think we see those here in Connecticut. Can you talk about that, Fiona?
Yes, I mean, yew trees are very remarkable. They're certainly the oldest trees in the UK, and some of them have probably been growing 4,000 years. I mean, they are quite extraordinary organisms. And so it's interesting because in the UK they're often found in churchyards, and it's likely that in some cases the tree was there before the church. It's likely that the church was sited where the yew tree was. But it's also interesting because yew trees, because they often are in churchyards, they have associations, religious associations with everlasting life. And that's something that actually connects very much to their kind of physical peculiarities, because they have this extraordinary ability to regenerate, which is why it's very difficult to tell the age of a very old yew tree, because as they age, new roots come down from the crown, and they sort of form a new trunk. So they are these extraordinary organisms.
And they do appear unusual, and from what my producer has told me, that they've symbolized gloom and they're highly poisonous.
That too, yeah. They're rather kind of mysterious trees. Again, because they are associated with graveyards, and they're very dark, obviously, because they're evergreens. That's given them this kind of gloomy character. But also, they are poisonous. So Shakespeare, for example, called them double fatal because they're poisonous, but also because they were the wood that were used for making longbows. So they were double fatal in that sense, being poisonous, but also likely to produce death when handled by an English archer, as Shakespeare would see it.
Another peculiarity, their sap is blood red.
Yes, that's right. So they can appear to bleed. There's a tree in Wales called the bleeding yew, and that gives a very sort of strange appearance. And they're associated with suicides, partly for, you know, kind of visual reasons, I think, but also because of them being poisonous. People have actually used them for that purpose.
What can you tell us about yew trees in Connecticut? Are there any?
I can say I'm grateful they're not native to Connecticut. people do plant yews in their yard for hedgerows, and they provide privacy, and they're an aesthetically pleasing tree. They don't naturalize in our forests. Occasionally you may come across one, but thankfully they stay in their place and behave.
Let's talk about a tree that we all appreciate in the autumn, and that's the apple tree, Fiona. Tell us about the apple tree.
Well, the apple tree, obviously its cultural significance goes right back to the Bible. It's the tree that's often seen as the tree that causes all the trouble in the book of Genesis when Eve puts out her hand and takes the fruit. It's not actually specified in the Bible, but it's often assumed to be an apple tree. So culturally it's there right from the beginning, and in most cultures it's associated with youth as well. You have the Celtic warriors feeding on apples, and the Viking gods feeding on apples. It's the tree of youth, really. But of course it's a kind of very wholesome tree. It's a tree that people obviously have planted because they like to eat apples, and you can do so much with apples. So I think it's very important in American culture. You'll be able to tell me more about that, but it seems to be as important in America as it is in Europe. So it's a tree that we all know. But again, I think certainly a lot of children in kind of a lot of people in cities don't necessarily really associate apples with trees. They buy them in the supermarket, but they don't necessarily think as they buy their apples, oh yes, this has come from a tree. So in Britain there's a kind of movement to raise awareness of orchards and the old kind of apple varieties, rather than just the rather limited kind that we get in the supermarket, all the old ones that they used to have. So we now have a relatively new festival called Apple Day, which takes place in the autumn, and it only started in 1990, but it's spreading, and there seem to be more and more Apple Days every year, and that sort of shows, I think, how people want to celebrate apples, but also celebrate the orchards and the trees that they come from.
We've been through a drought here in Connecticut. I know very dry summers the last couple of years. I wanted to turn back to our state forester, Chris Martin. I had gone to a farm to pick apples, and they only had a couple of varieties. They mentioned the drought was a factor. Tell us about how that's impacted the apple trees here.
Well, there's a couple of things that are happening with the apple trees. One was, you might call last winter being very mild, and actually December being very, very mild. And there was a weekend in February where we got well below zero. Mm-hmm. The trees had actually started to bud in February, which is, you know, highly unusual. And that freeze did wipe out the peach crop completely and really impacted the apple trees. This year, the apples are a bit smaller because of the lack of moisture. But the good side on that is the smaller the apple, the sweeter it tends to be. When we have a wet summer, they get bigger, but the taste is not quite as succinct.
And Fiona, we just have a couple of minutes left. Please tell us, what's your favorite tree from writing this book?
Oh, that's a question that's too hard to answer. I find that it depends a little bit on what mood I'm in as to what my favourite tree is, because they're so varied. But actually, I do have a soft spot for some of the trees that certainly in the UK are regarded as kind of not really proper trees. Things like the sycamore, because I think it's a really beautiful tree, but it tends to be regarded as a little bit common. So I have a soft spot for the sycamore.
And Chris, I'll ask you.
Oh, well, I have to vote for the white oak, the charter oak. And we have a ship, the old Ironsides, that was built in Connecticut that was impenetrable to cannonballs. So oak is just, and white oak in particular, is just a really tough old good tree.
And we can't forget the sugar maple here in Connecticut.
Oh, yes. There's several favorites, actually, if I'm to be honest.
A quick email from Matthew, a listener. He comes from a part of the state where an organization called Joshua's Trust takes care of a lot of woodlands. He writes, I think it's a fantastic resource for the surrounding communities, and wonders if there are similar organizations in other parts of the state. We'll ask Chris, our state forester, that after the break, and we'll put some links up on our website for listeners who want to get more information. But I do want to thank Fiona Stafford again. She's the author of The Long, Long Life of Trees. Thank you so much for joining us today from the UK, Fiona.
Thank you very much. It's been really interesting.
And also, Chris Martin, Connecticut State Forester. We'll be back after the break to talk about what one researcher is doing in the canopies of rainforest trees in Borneo. But first, do you appreciate where we live? If so, here are two very nice people, my colleagues, to remind you, we need listener support to keep quality programs on the air like Where We Live. Thanks for listening. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Monday, when was the last time you changed your address? Well, if you're like most Americans, it probably wasn't that long ago. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, the average resident will move 11.7 times in his or her lifetime. On the next Where We Live, we rebroadcast our show about what it takes to truly love where you live. That's Monday. Today we've been talking about trees, and to hear about some really interesting research going on, I'm joined now by WNPR's Patrick Scahill. He's our science and environment reporter and host of The Beaker. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Lucy.
And joining us by phone is Kevin McLean. He's a Fulbright National Geographic Digital Storytelling Fellow who recently completed his PhD at the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. Kevin, welcome to Where We Live.
Hi, thank you.
So there's a little bit of a delay. I'll let our listeners know you're actually joining us by phone from Borneo. So tell us what you're doing there.
Yeah, that's right. I'm in the state of Sabah, which is one of the two states of Malaysia that's on the island of Borneo. I had to take a look at a map before I actually came here. There's three different countries on the island of Borneo: Brunei, Malaysia, and Indonesia. And I'm in the eastern part of Borneo doing research on wildlife that lives in the canopy of rainforest here.
I understand from talking with, again, Patrick Scahill, who is our science reporter, this kind of research is fairly rare up in the canopies of a rainforest tree?
So what I'm doing is just some baseline surveys of the wildlife using these motion-sensitive cameras or camera traps. And camera traps are a really common tool used to study animals in forests all over the world, but not a lot of people are using them up in the trees, even though myself and a few other researchers have shown that they actually perform pretty well.
And tell us about, so we were focusing on trees here in the UK, also in New England, but when we're talking about rainforest trees, what kind of trees are you climbing?
The trees that are the forests here in the lowlands of Borneo are called, it's called a dipterocarp forest, and dipterocarp refers to the seeds of these trees. They have two wings on them, and these trees are really, really tall, some of the tallest in the tropics. Actually, the tallest top tropical tree in the world is right here in Borneo, almost 300 feet tall. So what you have are really, really tall trees, 200, almost 300 feet, that live in really, really wet and humid forests.
So, Kevin, you mentioned some of these trees are really, really tall. I mean, 300 feet, that's a ways to go up. So describe a bit how you get up in the canopy and how you kind of lug all your gear up there? I mean, I would imagine you're sweating a lot and you have to carry like heavy cameras and all this other stuff. So how do you get it up there?
Yeah. It is quite a haul to get myself up there. So basically, I use an 8-foot tall slingshot to shoot. Basically, it's sort of like a beanbag that's attached to a string. I shoot that string over whatever branch I can reach, and then I tie that string to my rope, and I pull my rope up into the tree, and basically create like a slip knot around the branch, and then I can climb up that rope. And if I need to get higher, then I throw that same beanbag up higher, and then I move myself from branch to branch all the way up into the crown of the tree. And actually, the cameras themselves are not that heavy, but it's certainly a lot of gear to get yourself up there.
And my understanding, Kevin, is you're a former gymnast. So I wonder if you can maybe kind of just describe, once you're up in the canopy, what's it like up there? How do you maneuver around, and how are the animals moving when they're up there?
Climbing straight up into the tree is pretty straightforward. The gear we use is similar to rock climbing gear. So going straight up is pretty simple. It's being able to maneuver on the branches to get myself into the right position to place the cameras that takes a long time. Now for me, I have to use different ropes to position myself just right. Between two different branches, between the trunk and another branch or something like that. And it really, really becomes clear how ineffective my method is in comparison to some of these other animals. Most species have really long tails that provide a counterbalance. Some of them have tails that are prehensile, so they can grab or even hang just from their tails alone. Here in Borneo, there's actually a lot of different flying squirrel species that use the large gaps in between these really tall trees to move really long distances from one place to the next.
I understand that there are some sloths that you have observed that are moving faster than you in these trees.
I've actually been up in the tree before trying to get to my one spot to set the camera. I had to move maybe 6 feet in front of me, and in that time I spotted a sloth go two trees by me. So we tend to think of sloths and some of the other animals as being very slow moving, but relative to what I'm capable of after, mind you, several years of training, they're pretty adept up there.
I'm talking with Kevin McLean. He's a Fulbright National Geographic Digital Storytelling Fellow. He's in Borneo in the rainforest canopies doing research that hasn't really been done before. What are you observing, Kevin, and what's the point?
Well, so far I've been climbing up and setting up these cameras as a means of just providing some baseline surveys for animals that live their entire lives up in the trees. Essentially, really what you need in order to study animals or protect them is an estimation of their populations. Basically, we have to get out there and count them. And we do that in a lot of different ways for different species. Sometimes it means walking through the forest and counting up what we see. Other times it means placing those cameras on the ground and counting up what walks in front of them. But for the canopy itself, the traditional methods that we use to serve those animals are really not very widely used. Before before we started using these camera traps up in the trees, the primary way to do that was to go out at night with a flashlight called a spotlight survey. You shine the light up into the trees and you try and guess what's looking back at you. Some people are really good at it, but it takes a lot of training. And because of that, not a lot of people end up doing it.
And so, Kevin, I mean, you had mentioned spotlight surveys, which I wanted to ask you about. But I guess just maybe talk a bit more about what you're seeing in your images that you're getting from these camera traps. I mean, a spotlight survey is something that, as you said, would take a bit of training to pull off successfully. But a camera, looks like we lost Kevin.
I think we did lose Kevin. Kevin was joining us from Borneo. So really interesting research that he's doing.
Really cool,
and
though.
I think that Patrick Scahill is here. He's a WNPR's science reporter. You're going to follow up on the research
Kevin actually was in the media lab here at our station and first told me about his research when he was over at Yale. And yeah, it'll be something that I definitely profile on the blog. He's going to be in Borneo for a few months, and then I think he's going to Ecuador for about 6 more months as well. So it's a year-long thing for him. Anyway, it's really cool.
It is. It's really cool. I can't imagine being up there 85 feet in the
air. I would
not
be able to handle it. There's absolutely no way.
But a good anecdote that he's a gymnast. So.
Exactly.
So thanks again for Kevin McLean, and we hope to reach him later to do some more reporting from WNPR's Patrick Scahill. But I did want to focus a little bit more on a story that you recently did,
yeah, sure.
Patrick, since we're focusing on trees and the forest here in Connecticut. Felling trees. Tell me where you went and what they're doing out there in Durham.
So I went out to Field Forest, which is over in Durham, and this is a property that's owned by the Connecticut Forest and Parks Association. And I went out there because they were doing a timber harvest, and I was basically just curious kind of why they were doing it. I mean, there's sort of the obvious reason, right, which is to get the wood to sell it, which was part of it. But there were some more kind of ecological reasons that were in play as well, which I'd be happy to talk about. So,
and so the point is they're helping trees, I guess, regenerate. So the dead
right.
versus waiting for nature to take its course.
Yeah.
And tree fall.
Yeah. So essentially, they're kind of doing two things when they do these timber harvests. One, they're playing a bit with space, kind of opening the forest up, mainly in the canopy, to allow more light to reach the forest floor to let seedlings grow, and to give trees that are already there or trees that get left behind from the harvest a better opportunity to develop their canopy and absorb more sunlight and become stronger. So that's kind of the playing with space. They're also sort of playing with time because, like, as you said, this would happen naturally through forest fires and things like that. But part of the reasoning behind this is to speed that process up a little bit and kind of just make it happen quicker so seedlings can regenerate faster.
So they're going out there and they're looking for trees that may be unhealthy and they just want to cut them down. So the ash tree for one.
Yeah. So ash is an interesting example. And we actually saw a few cases of ash at Field Forest that were sort of in varying stages of decay thanks to emerald ash borer. And that can be a little bit tricky because if the decay gets really advanced, it can make the wood kind of not sellable on the market because it gets messed up essentially. But if it's kind of not as far advanced, then you can still sell the wood because it doesn't actually damage the inside of the tree, which is where the wood comes from that they actually sell. So.
When you were talking to the people working out there, you know, do people get upset when they see these crews cutting down these trees and they may not understand, you know, why?
Yeah, they definitely
here
do.
Here in Connecticut, yeah.
And this is something that, you know, an argument that foresters are having to say over and over again is, hey, well, we're taking the long view here and we are doing this to make the forest stronger to ensure that your trails look really nice in the future. So that's one part of it. The other part that's always a little bit tough to explain is, once the harvest is done, obviously trees are gone, but slash and brush is left behind. So there's trees that are on the ground that are kind of just left there. And that's done to control things like water runoff and erosion, also to make it so that the machines that are out there doing the logging don't mess up the forest floor. So that stuff gets left behind, and some people don't really understand why that's there. But there's a reason for all of it, and trust me, tons of planning does go into these calculated timber harvests.
And you can go to WNPR.org to hear and read more about Patrick's story. Also, a great video from WNPR's digital reporter,
wonderful
Ryan
video,
Karen
yeah.
King. That's at WNPR.org. Now, we've had a caller that's been on hold for a while. I just wanted to go quickly. Bill from New Haven, we just have a couple of minutes. I know you had a special thing you want to do on our air here.
Yep, that's me, Bill Fisher from New Haven. A friend of mine who's a second-year violin student at the Boston Conservatory. She introduced me to an oak tree up at the summit of East Rock Park in New Haven. And she wrote this song about trees in general, but that tree in particular. For each child that is born, hundreds of trees are all around. Please, tree, teach me how to be strong like you. Teach me how to put my roots deep in the ground. Thank you for being my friend. Thank you for being. That's it.
All right, Bill. Well, I think that's a great way to end our tree show. Bill, before you go, what's your favorite tree? Is it the oak?
My favorite tree actually is the ginkgo.
The ginkgo. And that's
I have a big one in my backyard.
Well, thank you so much for that tree song. We appreciate it for the end of our tree show today. Again, I want to thank Kevin McLean. He was with us earlier in the segment. He's a Fulbright National Geographic Digital Storytelling Fellow. Great research being done in Borneo. And WNPR's Patrick Scahill. He's our science and environment reporter, host of The Beaker. Is it thebeaker.org?
Yep.
So if you want to read some of Patrick's blog and his great reporting here at WNPR, you can go there or our website, WNPR.org. Do you love WNPR? It's our fall membership drive. We'd love your support of where we live. Our listeners are passionate. We hope that you can translate that passion for public radio into dollars to support WNPR. Here are two of my colleagues to tell you how to pledge your support. And thanks for listening.